It's a great pleasure for us to have Silvio Micali here today for our distinguished lecture. Silvio is the Ford Professor of Engineering at MIT. He has done groundbreaking work in many areas of theoretical computer science, including cryptography, zero-knowledge proofs, pseudo-randomness, and mechanism design. He's also a member of the National Academy of Sciences, the National Academy of Engineering, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. I have to look at my cheat sheet because it's so long. He's a recipient of the Gödel Prize in Theoretical Computer Science, the RSA Prize in Cryptography, and most recently the Turing Award. So it's a great pleasure to have you. Thanks.
So thank you very much, Anna, for inviting me, and thank you all. I had a terrific visiting day, so I promise to come back if you can stomachache me. And thank you, congratulations, by the way, for the great building and the next one that is going to come, and congratulations to Professor Patel for winning his award and for giving me this great t-shirt that I will proudly wear today. So, proofs, secrets, and computation. So today, I'd like to talk about something that we all know and love, proofs. So I must say that I was enamored by proofs since a very long time. I found them very mysterious. This is a reminiscence for the first criterion for triangular congruence, if you remember, right? If two sides are equal and the angles in between is equal, two triangles are all equal. And I remember that for me was a source of great puzzlement. Because I'm saying, how the hell are you know? So look at these other two angles. You never measure them, right? The other side, you never measure them. You only measure some part, and you know that something else that you've never really experienced firsthand is true. So I got convinced and I say, that cannot possibly be, because you know, on the right, I'm saying more things than it is on the left. So this should be the case. How can this be? So there is only one explanation. And the explanation is that proofs can actually be very practical. I got convinced that this is not to be the case, because it saves me a lot of time to walk over there and measure those angles. I stay local, I prove things, I don't need to walk over there. What can be more practical than that? All right. So what are proofs? Well, you know, proofs have been with us for a long time. That's my best rendition from classical Greece, but at least in my tradition, that's where proofs come from. And then they proceeded with Gödel and Turing. There they are. By the way, I want to recall them. Usually, iconography for these two guys shows them a bit more beaten up by life. But I'd like to recall them as we all should be recalled, you know, young and invincible, look at them. And so they're very different characters. For those of you who are not in the trade, on the left we have an Austrian mathematician, extremely precise, the type of guy who can dive into the Pacific Ocean and re-emerge with a proof in his teeth, no matter what it takes. And the other guy is a brilliant British man with a totally different approach to science, right? He really simplifies things by conceptualizing them, and simplifies them, simplifies and simplifies. And when it's done, the theorem proves itself. It's like picking up flowers in a grassy field in a sunny day. Nothing beats what the Turing does. So either those guys, at the end, they told us to say that proofs are strings with very special syntactic properties. First of all, let me object, because as you say, what are proofs? Proofs is something that convinces me, period. Don't bug me with a formal definition of a proof. Or proofs are something elegant, something that to enjoy, blah, blah, blah. I know, but if I want to prove theorems about proofs, we need to define our things. And you cannot prove, for instance, the incompleteness theorem of Gödel, who kind of disappeared from the picture, without really having a formal definition of a proof. So let us bear for a second for a formal definition. You know, mathematicians have actually distilled the following. They say a proof is essentially is a sequence of lines. You can write down an axiom anytime you please. Between two points, there is only one line. At any time, you can say that. And then if you write down something that A implies B, and at some point in time, you write A alone, then you are right to write B alone. and so on and so forth. And you write, and the theorem is true if the statement appears at the last line. Right? Wonderful. Thank you, Gödel, and thank you, Turing. But there is a problem here. How about efficiency? You know, these proofs can be astronomically long if you derive them in this way, right? And why is efficiency important? Efficiency, I claim, is important in all proofs because if you don't care about efficiency, you say, here is theorem X, prove it yourself. Because why? Because it's, what's my point? So if we look at proofs, behind the scenes, whether we like it or not, there's lurking two characters. One is the prover. And we insist that the prover is hardworking. See if I care how long he or she takes to find the proof, right? In fact, the better would be that the prover works hard. Why? Because otherwise all mathematicians would be out of a job. Who needs them, right? So here is our prover. We say if he works infinite time, I don't care. So he's a kind of a magician that he can really work very hard. But the verifier, which is most of us in most of the time, we really insist that they want to be lazy. How lazy? Very lazy, okay? So we want it to be a polynomial time. We can work very infinite time versus a polynomial time. And so what is a proof? Now a proof is whatever it is. It's something that I write down so that you know, the verifier can read it. And so if this is what a proof, then what are the efficient proofs? And this question was actually answered in the 70s by a certain gentleman called Cook, Cartman, Levin, and they say is MP. And essentially means the proofs are efficient, and the proofs that are short and easy to verify. Seems correct. If it's short and easy to verify, then that ought to be all the right to be called efficient. Good. Let me give you by example. Assume that I want to prove that these two graphs, G and H, are isomorphic. Isomorphic, what does it mean? Well, they are the same graphs, except that they are drawn differently. So in other words, you can rename these two graphs, right? And in fact, that's what you know, you can tell that these two graphs are the same, but you say you need really a theorem for this, not for these graphs, but for these graphs, yes. Right? Because if I give you these spaghetti things over there, can you tell them if they are the same graphs drawn differently or not? No, therefore, we need the proof. Prover, could you please oblige to prove these two graphs are isomorphic? Yes, and the proof, pi for proof, consists of a correspondence. Vertex 1 on the left corresponds to vertex 2. Vertex 2, you remember, is on the top there, corresponds to vertex 5 over there, which is in the middle. How do you verify such a proof? You simply verify that this correspondence preserves the edges, which means that if I is linked to j in one graph, then pi of I has to be linked to pi of j in the other graph and vice versa. So notice that, you know, because even if there are 10,000 nodes, there are at most 10,000 square edges that you have to check that they are preserved. That's easy to do. So that is an efficient proof. Very good. The verifier is happy. Now, efficient proofs, essentially, if you say, look, it's not clear what they capture that given an equation, and we all have asked, no matter what our field is, to solve an equation once in a while, right? So we want to say, given the following equation, find that zero. And that is really MP. You want to prove that there exists a solution. And you can see that it may take you a long time to solve the equation, but once you do, you hand the solution to somebody else, they can plug it in and verify easily. And that's what is MP. How about, however, if I want to prove that this equation of a given equation has no solution? This is not clear. So if there is a solution, as a proof, I exhibit the solution. But if there is no solution, what do I give you that you can plug in and verify? Isn't clear. And that is called co-NP. And then what about if I want to prove that this equation has 2 to the 16 plus 17 solutions? Even if I give you so many things that is going to take an astronomical amount of time, how do you know that I'm not adding another one, right? And then, never mind, there are other questions that we can ask about these things. All right. So that's what I conclude is to say, either do we want to live in a world in which we cannot prove to somebody else after working for a long, 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 long time in an easy way to verify that, you know, this equation, your equation, has no solution. Do we want or we don't want? I don't know what you think, but I don't. So I think, therefore, we need to update our notion of what an efficient proof is. So, okay, how do we update it? First of all, let's go back to the basics. What do you want from a proof system? When you boil down to it, when you distill it, you get essentially you want two things. A, that it's possible to prove all true theorems, and B, it should not be possible to prove a false theorem. At the end, it is as simple as that. That's all you want. Very good. So therefore, let me define another type of efficient proof called interactive proofs, which were put forward 10 years later by these guys. And let me tell you what they are. You never saw this definition of a proof, at least most of you, right? 90% of you. What you found is this interactive process on the left. Somebody on the blackboard, or Q&A, right, and then try to convince you interactively. So all of a sudden says, you know, why did we, when we are accustomed to the interactive model on the right, why did we formalize it on the left? Mystery. So let me actually tell you a little bit that IP corresponds to the proofs as a game, and let me tell you what I mean. I mean the following. Forget proving things formally, axiom, blah, 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 blah. I want to convince you that the theorem is true. I'm going to set it up as a game with the following conditions. If the theorem is true, I win all the time. I can win all the time if I want to. If the theorem is false, I must lose at least half of the time. Okay? And let's assume now that we play and I win. Say, play again. We play and I win. Play again. We play and I win. I play and I win. I win and I win. Now, if it is true that if the theorem is true, I have a winning strategy all the time, but if it's not, I must lose at least half of the time. If I win, 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 win 30 times in a row, what do you conclude? The theorem is true or is false? It better be true, or you are very, very unlucky, right? Good. Okay, so let me give you an example. This actually is the simplest possible example that is due to joint work with two friends of mine, Oded Goldreich, the G there, and Avi Vigdason, the W there. Okay, this time I want to prove that these two graphs are not isomorphic. They are not the same. There is no correspondence that preserves the edges. And you can actually see by eye inspection that that is true, right? All right, but if these were the graphs, you would not see it by eye inspection. Let me prove that these two graphs are not isomorphic. The G is not isomorphic to H. What can the prover send you? That's a very big question. Because there are, now, how many permutation correspondences there are if there are just 1,000 vertices in the graph? 1,000 factorial. That is more than the number of particles, of elementary particles in our universe, which is only 2 to the 300. So 1,000 factorial is absurdly big. So then, this is not an efficient thing, because I cannot send you, there is not enough matter in the universe to write down so many correspondences. Okay, so then we remember that we only care about true theorems are to be proven, false are not. We set it up as a game, let's go. Let me show that, you know, true theorems are provable, in particular, this theorem is provable. But whenever a graph G is not the same as H, Merlin, the prover, can demonstrate it to Arthur, the verifier. Okay, here is how it goes. Arthur barricades himself in a Faraday cage, in a room, locks the door. And what does he do in this room? He flips a coin to choose between G and H. Let's say that the coin came up head, he chose G. Then flips coins again to find a random renaming of the vertices. One through M, say one, I call it now 517. Two, I call it 704, and so on and so forth. Then permutes the vertices of G according to the permutation pi that he did, and he obtains a third graph C, and he ships it to Merlin. And then he says, dear Merlin, to which of these two graphs, G and H, is C isomorphic to? Now, you notice that by construction, C is isomorphic to G, right? Because I took G, I changed the name, and I concocted C. So C is the same as G. So, and if the Merlin tells him G realizes right away within infinite time that G is the same as H, and he tells you G. And now the king says, that's right. Okay? If we do this again, the Merlin will win again, will manage to convince the king again. If you do it twice, right, he convinces it twice. But let's assume, so therefore, only is left to do is that we know already that true theorem can be proven. How about false theorem? Now, let's prove that false theorem are not provable. So let's assume now that the graph G, right, which used to be not the same, the theorem is false, means general G is the same as H. Okay? And if the theorem is C is the same as H, then when the king constructs C in the same manner, now the graph C is both isomorphic to G and H. So how can Merlin guess what the king is thinks G is isomorphic to, right? Before, when G is not the same as H, and somehow the king randomizes the graph G, the graph C could only be equal to G. But now it could be equal to both Z and H. So Merlin does not know what he has to say. In the moment in which he opens his mouth, he's going to make a mistake. He's going to say G or H, different from whatever the king knows, with probability half. Is this clear to everybody? And if you do it twice, the fact that he's never caught, the probability is a fourth. And if you do it k times, where k is 300, the probability is 1 and 2 to the k, less than the number of elementary particles in the universe. We are done. Okay? Okay, I'm very fond of this stuff, because let me tell you, as a kid, I had a very tough father. And my father was very tough because he believed that morality trumped everything else. And he was in law, as a matter of fact. And so I was actually trying to push him to say, listen, is this dead? Is this behavior legal? Blah, 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 blah. He goes, what do you want to do that? He says, who said I want to do that? I'm just saying, is it legal in our legal system? You want to do that? No, I'm saying, is it legal? Suspecting that I may want to enact that, he says, yes. The answer is actually no. And then he says, but why? Last time you told me that this is legal. I never said that. I said something different. Blah, blah, blah. And so I realized that pretty soon some very big foggy thing appeared in which I realized that he was actually not telling the truth. And so I set up a very complex scheme to catch him so at least I would know, because I needed to depend on him for to know what is true and what is not false in life, but I knew that he wanted to orient me towards good behavior. So I developed a bunch of techniques. And in some sense, that could be thought as a one technique like this, right? That works, sort of, that you can let you get from some omnipotent prover, right? The truth when it's true, but you are not going to be cheated by no matter how omnipotent this guy might be. So when people say, you know, how did you think about this model? You go, did I tell you about my father? Okay, so now we have a wonderful alternate definition of efficient proofs. Whatever is interactive proof, in the sense you transform it into a game that you can win all the time, or you can win at most half of the time. And turns out that whatever you could prove efficiently before, you can prove efficiently in the new sense. But now you can prove that an equation has no solution. Or you can count how many solutions you have. You can prove how many solutions you have. And you can actually even prove whatever P space is. And by the way, that's what I didn't want, why I did not want to define it before, because what is P space? Now that you understood what IP is, well, it is IP, so there is nothing to define. All right. So what? Okay. Well, let me tell you the so what. So you know that these days it's been very trendy to say, don't keep the data with yourself. Upload it to the cloud. So why do you want to do this computation that obliges you to buy a supercomputer? You know, subcontracted to the cloud. So in the cloud, somehow, metaphorically, there is this gigantic thing to which we can ask questions. And you say, here is x and what is, and here is f. And the cloud, while responds, oh, f of x is 27. And by the way, is your bill, right? And to say, thank you very much for your trust. Trust? What trust? Right? So I need, if I can subcontract to the cloud, I get an answer. Then I want a proof that the answer is correct. And then you say, well, compute it to yourself. Well, I wouldn't ask you the cloud if I knew how to compute it yourself. So I want that the proof to be efficient, super efficient. The computation may not be. So it's exactly what we need for an interactive proofs. And therefore, a few decades later, it turns out it is true. Proofs may be very practical. Our ability to upload things to the cloud will depend on these efficient proofs. Okay, but you know, proofs are very big things. It's a very kind of a sleeping giant foot here, and we start tickling it. They may wake up. So now they want to do a little bit more with the proofs, and let's say we start talking about the zero knowledge proofs. Okay. Here is the question I want to tackle. How much knowledge do you need to verify a proof? Certainly, you need enough to make sure that the theorem is correct, but exactly how much? Well, here is a better question. What is knowledge? Here is another better question. So let me tell you that we have to be very careful about, you know, dealing with knowledge. And say knowledge is a very old issue, right? There are thousands of years of philosophy in debating what knowledge is. And who am I? I barely understand what they say. How am I going to do this? Fortunately, you see, the questions will always change. Because if you look at this pen, right, and then I let it go and folds, now, if you ask the first guy, Aristotle there, the way he says, oh, that's an interesting phenomenon, what he was thinking is the pen folds towards the F. The answer is, where does he want to go? That was the question he was answering. Few hundred years later, Galileo went to the Tower of Pisa, left a pen, he fell down. He didn't ask the same question. He asked, you know, how does he fall? Never mind why. Who cares where he wants to go? Now, I want to know how. I say, oh, if it's how, it's a simpler question. And he can use like the quadratic law, he figured out this, bingo. You know, the fact that the question will change is actually fortunately. So I want to do the same thing. I want to change the question. What is knowledge? Who cares? I don't know what knowledge is, but I can tell you what zero knowledge is, okay? All right. And therefore, in essence, that it's zero knowledge proofs is that it is a way to convince that something is true, revealing nothing else but the truth itself. Okay, that's what I want to do. And how do I start? The first axiom says efficient computation is for free. What does it mean? Assume that I meet you on the street, and I have an integer on my left hand and an integer on my right hand. And he says, oh, hello, welcome. I have the following proposal. For $1,000, I can sell you the product of these two integers. What do you say? Multiplication is polynomial time, right? It's a shift and add, right? You know, the hell is I know to multiply efficiently, so I can compute this myself. I don't pay you $1,000. I save $1,000. Thank you very much. Good. What does the second axiom say? The day after, unable to sell you the greater than $1,000 one way, I find another venue. Says, hey, welcome back. Says, for $1,000, I sell you 100 random bit strings. Says, I beg your pardon? I have a coin exactly as I do. I can flip it 100 times myself, and I save $1,000, right? So that is essentially what this axiom means, that efficient computation and random bits are for free. It's like the air we breathe. We don't pay for it. Just wait 100 years, right? Things will change soon. So let me put this at the following thing. Here is the theorem, right? The prover wants to convince the verifier that the graph G is actually the same as graph H, and we know how to do it. We give the correspondence. That's the proof. Now I want to say that this, no matter how you define knowledge, this correspondence is a little bit too much knowledge. Think of it, right? I only want to know one bit. Are these two graphs the same, yes or no? When you say yes, but not only the same, let me tell you why exactly they are the same. You see, they give you the correspondence. That is a way much more information that I'm asking for. Therefore, let me give you an alternative proof that does not release too much information. OK, so here is the theorem. Claim G is isomorphic to H. And see, here is what happens. Merlin flips a coin, and because G is indeed the same as H, he concocts a third graph C, which is isomorphic to both, which is equal to both, because the two are equal to each other. Then now the king say, flip a coin. Thank you, Merlin. You tell me that G is isomorphic to both G and H. Prove to me that it's isomorphic to G. So, okay. Here is the correspondence phi that preserves the edges between G and H. Now you know that really G is indeed the same as H, because you just give you the correspondence. Then, therefore, the verifier says, OK. Now, and it is very clear that when Jesus is morphic to H, the prover wins all the time. Because no matter what graph C gets, and no matter what the king asks him to prove it is isomorphic to G or to H, he has a way to do it, and he does it, and he wins all the time. We have also to prove that when the theorem is false, this is not true, but it's so simple that I will omit the proof. But you can see how the proof is going to go. If G is not the same as H, and I give a third graph C, either is not isomorphic to G or is not isomorphic to H. So I have a chance, at least I have, to be caught cheating. All right. That is an alternative proof. But why? What does this proof more spatial? It's more cumbersome than the previous one, gives him a correspondence. I give you a graph, you choose between G and H, and then I give you a correspondence anyway. That is an alternative proof. Yes, but this other proof is zero, gives you zero additional knowledge. I want to claim that from this proof, we can only distill out that G and H are the same, but nothing else. So how do you know? You ask me to think, you give me a correspondence anyway, it's not clear to me. Very good. Let me explain why. Let us assume, I want to prove that this way of proving things reveals that something is true, but nothing else but the truth itself. Let's assume that there was no Merlin, right? Or he's abroad on a vacation. So the king is going to say, well, here's what I'm going to do. In my head, I'm going to flip a coin and generate a graph G. Can a limited polynomial time king do that? Sure, flipping a coin, anybody can do. That's for free, remember, in the model. Then let me choose a random renaming of the vertices, of the numbers between 1 and 1,000. Can I randomly rename the vertices? Who stops you from doing this? This is trivial. Then let me apply this permutation to obtain a new graph C. Can I do this? Sure you can. Good. Now that I've done this on my head, the king picks a piece of paper and writes down C with an arrow from above an arrow from right to left, then G above an arrow from left to right, and then phi, the correspondence from above an arrow from right to left. And now, let's compare what happens here in his head alone with what happened with Merlin. What is C in both cases? See, on the right, by construction, C was a random graph isomorphic to both G and H. And on the left, what it is? It's still a random graph, right? Because I take, you know, G, I permuted the vertices of G, then I get a random copy of G. So C is a random, and if the theorem is true, namely if G is isomorphic to H, this C, in both cases, is a random graph isomorphic to both. What is G? Next, on the right is a random bit, and on the left is a random bit. This bit is flipped before, and this bit is flipped afterwards, but it still is a random bit. And what is phi? In both cases is a correspondence with the graphs of G and the graphs of C. So in other words, whatever this conversation on the right is absolutely equal to this conversation that the king can have with himself in his own head. So when I'm asking, say, how this proofs on the right proves that G is isomorphic to H, but nothing else, I can back it up that nothing else is released. Why I can back it up? Because whatever you use, I can distill it to understand that G and H are the same. But nothing else exists there. Why? Because whatever you did, I can reconstruct exactly with the same odds, the same probability, by myself. By only doing flipping coins and doing polynomial time computation, things that are for free. Okay? That essentially is the idea. By the way, I'm lying a little bit, but I can make things more complicated to complete the proof, but that is the essence of the proof. Okay. Let me tell you, that actually, that, let me put it in another way. I hope this is clear. If it's not clear, just a small story. I think I was, you know, many, many years ago. I was, in fact, a kid, I don't know, maybe. I got an attack, classic attack or classic solipsism. So what does that mean? Well, nothing. The usual thing, that you believe the world out there doesn't exist and is only a product of your imagination. Okay. So as a result, why to take out my pajama? I mean, the world doesn't exist, so why to go to school? So I stayed in bed. I didn't have a beard at the time, so there was no need to shave, but otherwise I would have grown a beard too. So, and my mother got a little worried, so she came in next to me and says, but why don't you get up? You know, she says, the world doesn't exist, it's all a poor imagination. She says, it's not true, I exist, I'm here next to you, blah, blah, blah. You are a poor imagination too. So, you know, that thought stuck because it was impossible to disambiguate whether everything was a product of my imagination or not, right? And somehow that is the same thing, right? So good news is that finally I got up out of the bed, and second good news, I actually made a career out of it. Okay, now this particular thing says, hey, you prove it to me that it's possible in zero knowledge, nothing but the truth, to prove that two graphs are the same. Can you prove only this theorem, or only a few theorems, or only a special class of theorem? Turns out, no, that everything provable is provable in zero knowledge. So it is an intrinsic property of computation, and is not a special theorem is not true. Okay. So what? Well, let me tell you so what. And to explain why this might actually be useful, let me talk about passwords. Passwords is a very ancient technique, right? A knight to go into the castle, it's the drawbridge, says, password, right? He's in everyone's, shall long live the king. Drawbridge opens, the knight gets it. Very good. Now, it had problems even back then. So, open sesame, he gets in, because if there is in the moat around the castle an enemy who hears the password, the next day he says, lower drawbridge, password, open sesame, and he gets in. That is problem one. There is another problem. And the other problem is that you see the guardian of the drawbridge up there? He must know the password too, right? So this prevents you from using the same password in different circumstances, like for instance, to log in at U of W or to log in at your bank. Because if you use the same password, the same drawbridge, he goes to Bank of America and says, open sesame, I'm here to withdraw $1 million, right? That would not work. So instead, here is something that works. I'm terrible with memory, and it's a very short supply, and so remembering password is a problem. But let's say that I use the following password, right? I take, you know, two large primes randomly. That's apparently is easy, something that if you don't know yet, you learn in an algorithm class very quickly. And then you can multiply, oh, that was easy since when you were high school, by shift and add. Now you obtain a product of two primes n. Turns out, but why is it easy to multiply two primes? So if I tell you 3 is a prime, 5 is a prime, the product is 15, if I tell you here is 15, is this the product of two primes? You say, certainly it is. It's 3 times 5. But if I give you 9, 7, 1, 1, 3, 4, 5, 5, 2, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, 3, and then count how many primes you have. So that is a very kind of hard theorem. So I'm going to make at MIT, which is this our logo there, I take two primes, I multiply them, I get a number n. I go to MIT and say, hey, Beverly, here is my number n. Anytime somebody proves to you that this n is product of two primes, let him have access to my files, let him do whatever he wants. And I go to Bank of America and say, hey, here is my number n, put it next to Silvio. Anytime that somebody proves to you that n is product of two primes, let them withdraw money, add money, wire out money, do whatever they want. He says, OK. And now, in the morning, when I want to log in at MIT, what do? I log in with a zero knowledge proof of this fact. But turns out it's a very efficient proof to give. And now, why does this work? Because remember, the proof is zero knowledge. So at the end of the thing, MIT is capable of verifying that it's me because he's convinced that n is product of two primes, but can impersonate me. No, because what does it mean that proof is zero knowledge? That is equivalent to know the statement, this n is product of two primes and nothing else. So if you don't know anything else, how can you prove it to anyone else? So that essentially is the quintessential password system, because it has perfect secrecy, non-impersonability, and even something which I don't want to discuss, but even as additional property, which is total deniability. So you know what? I think proofs can be very practical. Good. So proofs are practical that, you know, the theoretical computer science community has an incredible appetite for proofs. It says, hey, I want the more the merrier. So now there is this spectacular sampleable proofs, and let me tell you what they are. Is a way that you take a proof, and a proof, unfortunately, has the nasty attitude that you have to read every single line, right? Because if I start assuming that 0 is equal to 1 in the middle of a proof, I can prove anything. So I take a proof, as long as it can be. I massage it around, and I put in very strange form. And once I put in the strange form, you can check whether it's true or not by sampling one character in the proof, a second character in the proof, and a third character in the proof, and check if there are a certain relationship holds. And if it does, you know that the proof is correct. Because otherwise, every time that you do this, you gain a confidence of one half of the proof is correct. So the probability of error decreases from one half to a fourth to 1 to 200, at which point we don't care anymore. Isn't this wonderful? It's not exactly efficient because you need to remassage the proof. A little bit gets longer, but even if it stays the same length, if the proof is long, its proof is long. Then there are these other things, CS proofs, that essentially that has a wonderful property. That means efficient proofs exist for all theorems. There is a small catch, that in this proof system, complete is both complete and inconsistent. Well, what does it mean? Here is what it means, that you can always prove X and non-X. What? Then what? In what sense is this a good proof system? Because proving a false theorem is extremely hard. So a proofs exist always for everything. But the proof of the truth is easy to find. And the proof for false stuff is still exists, but nobody will be able to find. And then, from this point of view, it's OK. Well, then there is also rational proofs. And what is this? Hey, it's a way to pay money for a proof. And what does this mean? Then I say, I tell you what f of x is. And you say, oh, f of x is 27. Do I know if this is right? Because I pay based on f, x, and 27. And if you set things properly, turns out that whatever I pay you depends on your answer, and you maximize your money, your payment, if you tell me the truth. So essentially, the truth here can be viewed as a maximization of function, and even easier to compute functions. So, to make a long story short, this, in the last 25 years, this notion of a proof is really is getting a lot of a construction going on. And we have seen very often in life, we've been able to construct cathedrals of great beauty across many centuries. And somehow it's a little bit of a miracle that in merely 25 years, this totally alternate construction has been done. And I really feel privileged to have witnessed and, to some extent, participated in this effort. So I want to conclude that proofs really that belong to mathematics only actually also belongs to computer science once you put efficiency into it. And not only that, but once you take these, you know, rational proofs even to the domain of economics. So these proofs actually, they tend to be quite ubiquitous, and everybody has something to contribute to it. I believe that proofs, like love and war, everything is fair. And what is proofs, love, and war? It's something that you can get only if you devote all the entire your entire being to it. So your brain, your emotions, your history, personal history, and even your sense of aesthetics. And I think that the really proofs are a miraculous construct of ourselves. There is the most traditional and formal thing, and yet is the most innovative and changing. They come for a far and will go far. Thank you.
Any questions?
Technical questions? You say every provable statement can be proved with zero knowledge.
Yep.
Do you mean every statement that is proving, proving P-space class, this one you mean, or only the class?
Actually, the question is, when you say that every true theorem can be proven, a true statement can be proven in zero knowledge, what do you mean? A theorem of a particular class? I think not necessarily that. It's not a question of the class. So I mean the following. So put an arbitrary bound of how much I can compute. Say Silvio cannot make more than 2 to the 500 steps of computations. Okay, if that is the case, you can prove things in a way. No matter what the theorem is, I can not extract more knowledge out of that proof unless I put more than 2 to the 500 steps of computation. That's what I mean. So it means you choose the theorem, and then you say you decide a priori how much knowledge should be retained and avoided to release excessive knowledge to anybody who is incapable of more than 2 to the 500 steps. Or if it's not enough, more than 2 to the 1,000 steps. If not enough, I say, and that's nothing to do with the theorem. The theorem remains fixed, but you can change it. That's what I mean.
Jeremy, and thanking Silvio.